Good afternoon. I'm Joe Broadhurst, and you're listening to a CKUT special presentation. Joining us from Boston on the phone is Professor Noam Chomsky. Good afternoon, Mr. Chomsky.
Hi. Glad to be with you.
Mr. Chomsky has agreed to answer questions from several members of the CKUT News Collective. In the studio, I'm joined by Mr. Dave Tassium, Ms. Brett Story, and Mr. Scott Bourne. Each member will have approximately 18 minutes, and we'll begin with Mr. Dave Tassium, who has been with the Collective for 6 months. Mr. Tassium.
Hello. My questions are essentially media-related. And my first question, we're all fairly aware of what the U.S. is prepared to accept in the ex-Soviet republics of Central Asia. But what about the Ukraine? Could the Orange Revolution be chalked up to something positive that the U.S. has finally done as an imperial force?
Well, the U.S. didn't have much to do with it. It was coming from inside the Ukraine. The Ukraine is sort of split. There's an eastern part and a western part, even geographically. The eastern part is mostly the old manufacturing section, working class, and so on. The western part is more oriented toward Western Europe. It's this bigger range of professionals and people who want to be part of Western European society. And the split was approximately that. It was kind of a class split. And the ones who want to be part of Western society are, they'll have more formal democratic systems, less in the way of support systems for working people and so on, and in some respects, like West and East Germany were. So there's a split, and the United States is, of course, on the side of the more westernized ones. But the developments, I think, as far as I can see, were mostly internal to Ukraine.
A year later, we don't see much of a positive upswing in Ukraine, though. It's true, isn't it?
Yeah, but look what happened after the fall of the Berlin Wall. I mean, after the fall of the Berlin Wall led to a, what more or less happened, this is the old Communist Party hierarchy. I figured they would be better off if they became like the typical third world elite. Which is what they become, you know, very corrupt, many of them very wealthy and so on, oligarchs, etc. But for the population, it was just a total disaster. I mean, there was an economic and demographic disaster in Eastern Europe. Nobody knows the numbers, but the extra deaths over the expected in Russia are estimated at somewhere in the 5 to 10 million range. I mean, that's almost at the level of Stalin's purge in the 1930s. And the economy went in a total tailspin. It became pretty much a third world economy. I mean, it's not badly off, but that's because they have a lot of resources. So you can sell a ton of oil and so on and so forth. But it's basically robbing resources to enrich sector of people who are very tightly linked to the West. If you visit Moscow, I've been there, but I read and am told, there's all the glitter of fashionable sections of New York, maybe more. But that's true of every third world country. On the one hand, a tremendous concentrated wealth and elegance and high fashion and so on, right next to very serious masses of serious poverty and even misery. That's the third world. That's basically what they became at a huge human cost and an enormous blow to the economy. Ukraine, that hasn't happened at least, but it's right. There hasn't been very much in the way of change, and I wouldn't really expect it.
I'm going to shift over to Iraq now and ask a question. Many seem to claim that after fumbling the ball initially, the media is now, mainstream media, doing a better job on Iraq coverage. Could you comment on that?
Well, frankly, I think the job is just shockingly embarrassing. That's not the U.S. media. It's all the Western media, as far as I know. I mean, suppose we were in Nazi Germany, let's say, in 1943. Would the only question be, how can we make sure that our efforts are a success? Is there a better strategy? did we make a mistake by starting a two-front war, and maybe we should do something else to try to make it work better? And was that the only question that could be asked? Just driving in this morning, I happened to be listening to National Public Radio. It's supposed to be the liberal media. And I happened to be listening to discussion of this. That's the only question. What went wrong? How can we make sure we succeed? Can we do it better? Were we misled into getting into the war? I mean, there's another question, after all. Same question that was raised at the Nuremberg trials. What right do you have to invade another country? Why were people hanged at Nuremberg? Because they committed what the Nuremberg tribunals called the supreme international crime, which encompasses within it all the evil that follows, namely the act of aggression, attacking another country. In fact, the German foreign minister, von Ribbentrop, one of the main charges against him was that he participated in a preemptive war, the invasion of Norway, on the grounds that it posed a threat to Germany, as in fact it did. But that was considered enough grounds for hanging him. The American justice at the chief counsel, American chief counsel at Nuremberg, Robert Jackson, at the end of the tribunal, when these noticed that the people charged at Nuremberg were not low-level soldiers who tortured somebody or pushed someone into a gas chamber or something. They weren't tried at Nuremberg. The ones who were tried were the leadership, top leadership. I mean, even if they never pushed anyone into a gas chamber, they're the ones who were charged. And Jackson gave an eloquent oration in which he said that these crimes, he said we should recognize that we are creating what he called a poison chalice. We may have to drink from it. If we commit the same crimes, we should be subjected to the same judgment. Otherwise, the trial of Nuremberg is not justice, but just punishment by the victors. Well, okay. Eloquent words. Anybody lived up to it ever since? Let's go back to Iraq. Can you think of a more open and flagrant case of plain, outright aggression? Does that question even arise? No, the only question that arises is, well, you know, how can we make the best success of it? And that's typical. You know, the same was true of the Vietnam War, outright aggression. The same was true of the U.S. terrorist war in Nicaragua, which in fact falls almost explicitly under the definition of aggression given by Justice Jackson at Nuremberg, although maybe you could just call it international terrorism if you want to be kind to the Reagan administration. Did these questions ever arise? Would the media ever even consider them? Not just the media, the journals of opinion, in fact, the scholarship. No, we just do not apply to ourselves the standards we insist upon for others, which is just, you know, that's the lowest level of moral depravity. I mean, the most elementary moral principle you can imagine is that you apply at least the same, you apply the same standards to yourself that you do to others. Actually, stricter standards, if you want to be serious, but at least the same standards. I mean, that's almost unthinkable in Western discourse, not just the media. And from then on, it just deteriorates. Everything follows from the total incapacity even to think the thought that we ought to be subject to the standards we impose on others. Anyone who proposes that is considered a madman or a kind of lunatic, a conspiracy theorist or whatever, supporter of Osama bin Laden or whatever the latest insult is.
An individual scandal that seems to be addressing the issue of why America went to war, and Judith Miller, I'm speaking of that. And we notice that the media focuses a lot on individuals and their scandals. And can any change be hoped for by looking at Libby and Rove and identifying the bad eggs?
Well, there are no bad eggs. I mean, it's kind of a striking fact about the... First of all, Judith Miller, I mean, her reports were awful, and it was obvious at the time. But wasn't it obvious to New York Times editors? I mean, they were saying pretty much the same things in their editorials. You take a look at their editorials, pretty much the same, you know. Got to do something. The next thing we'll hear from Iraq will be a mushroom cloud, and so on and so forth. And that's across the board, not just the New York Times. I don't read the Canadian press that carefully. roughly, but I'll bet it's the same. Nuances of difference. I mean, there's a very striking fact about the political situation in the United States now. I mean, so striking that many mainstream political commentators have pointed it out. The Bush administration and the Republican Party are in pretty serious straits. There's a lot of popular disaffection with them. They don't like what they're doing. You know, they've gotten themselves into all kinds of domestic and international disasters. But the Democrats aren't gaining anything from it. The only thing that they're gaining is decline in the popularity of the Bush administration. Why aren't they presenting some alternative? Well, you know, there's a reason. They really don't have any alternative to present. They mostly went along with all of this. What are they going to say?
Well, there's an alternative path, perhaps, that I've read about in the work of Gary Hart, Senator Gary Hart, who says in a recent book of his, I think it's called The Fourth Power, that America should consolidate itself as a republic, the republic that it once was. And he softly criticizes the imperial aspirations of America. Is that an alternative?
Yeah, that's what most of the population wants. But if you take a look at, I mean, public opinion in the United States is studied with great intensity. And if you look at public opinion, yes, it turns out that both political parties are very far to the right of the general population on a whole host of issues, including this one. I mean, the large majority of the public, it takes a pretty conservative view of the UN Charter, which rules out very explicitly any kind of preemptive war. That's the major war crime. And the public says the same thing. Large majority of the public says that the use of force should not be permitted except under attack or imminent threat of attack, which, of course, didn't arise at this point. Why did the public, at least the majority of it, support the war? Well, you know, because there was a government media propaganda campaign beginning in September 2002 that really frightened people. Yeah, Saddam Hussein's coming to get us. You know, we got to cower in fear. The New York Times and everyone else was part of it. So yes, people were afraid. Our lives are in danger. We got to protect ourselves. Well, you know, we don't have to talk about that anymore. But the public was driven into war, and that's true on this case, and it's true on a whole range of other cases. So it's a very simple, quite conservative proposal as to how to create an alternative in the United States, namely pay some attention to the attitudes of the public, to public opinion. There's an enormous gap between public opinion and public policy. Well, an alternative is to let public opinion have some influence, maybe a significant influence on policy. Or to put it simpler, more simply, an alternative is to move towards becoming a functioning democracy instead of a system with formal democratic forms, but very little substance. The public just isn't part of it and knows it, incidentally. It's one of the reasons for the disaffection. So sure, there are alternatives, but the political leadership, the media, corporate system are not going to push them. They don't want the public opinion to have a role in policy. And there's a good reason when you look at what public opinion is. So if, take, for example, just take one example. Every roughly February, the administration comes out with a budget. So last February, the second Bush administration came out with its federal budget. Well, immediately after the budget came out, there was a serious study by the major polling institution in the country of people's attitudes toward the budget. Turns out that they're virtually a mirror image of the budget, where the budget was going to go up, population wanted it to go down, and this is large majorities, incidentally. So military spending, supplementals for Iraq and Afghanistan, that sort of thing. Budget going way up, public wants to go way down. Where the budget is going down, public wants it to go up, again by large majorities. Social spending, education, renewable energy, huge majorities, support for the United Nations, enormous majorities, and so on. When you get to taxes, a very large majority of the public wants to rescind Bush's tax cuts for the rich. That is for people with incomes over $200,000, which is the major tax cuts. That's an overwhelming majority. Congressional plans are to cut it further. I mean, in fact, it's almost a caricature. The opinions and budget are virtually a mirror image. Well, in a democratic society, there's nothing more important than for people to know what, you know, their neighbors think. How can you have a functioning democratic society if each person thinks, I must be a lunatic because what they tell me in the press is everybody thinks something else? You know how much coverage this had? Zero. There was a big search by some people who do databases who couldn't find one report, even in a small newspaper, of people's attitudes toward the budget. Well, that's pretty typical. And it indicates, doesn't suggest, a very serious erosion of functioning democracy, which does suggest a very definite and extremely conservative alternative. Let's reconstruct a more democratic society. Nothing about democracy promotion in Iraq, which is a joke. How about democracy promotion right here?
I'm Joe Broderst, and you're listening to a CKUT special presentation with Noam Chomsky. And now we'll hear from Ms. Brett Story, who has been with the CKUT News Collective for 3 years. Ms. Story.
Hi, Professor Chomsky. Thanks for speaking with us this afternoon.
Glad to.
I'd like to just continue with this domestic focus for a little while and ask you a few questions about the mechanisms of power as deployed here in liberal democracies such as Canada and the United States. First, I'd just like to ask you to comment on what seems to be the most glaring repudiations of international law and indeed even domestic moral sensibilities enacted by the Bush administration, which is the installation of torture into the fabric of American military and intelligence operations. This is exemplified, of course, in recent revelations of secret CIA interrogation facilities in Eastern Europe, but also the legislated attempts to exempt CIA operations from John McCain's anti-torture amendment to the Defense Appropriations Bill. I just was wondering if you could comment about the functions you think this commitment to torture serve very specifically in the modern context and the modern political landscape.
Well, you're quite right. It is very shocking. I mean, so shocking that it has scandalized constitutional lawyers, you know, conservative historians of the justice system and so on. You take a look at the journals of international law and so on, they're just utterly outraged. The Journal of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, which is about as respectable as you can get, had an article by a very distinguished academic specialist and lawyer constitutional lawyer, in which he said, literally, he said that the eminence grise of the Bush administration, he said, is Carl Schmitt, that was Hitler's legal counselor. And then he went on to say that the concept of presidential authority being crafted by the Justice Department is following Carl Schmitt's concept of what the Führer is allowed to do. You don't find words like that in super respectable conservative journals very often. And there's very detailed discussions in the law journals. Yeah, it's outrageous. Gonzalez, who was considered too liberal to be appointed to the Supreme Court, he was the president's legal counsel. And he gave some very interesting advice to the president in a memorandum of 2002. First of all, he said that we should put aside the Geneva Conventions, which are the foundations of modern international humanitarian law, because he said their provisions are, his words were, quaint and obsolete. Okay, so we get rid of that. And then he advised Bush as his legal counsel, to formally rescind the Geneva Conventions, elements of them, because he said that would reduce the probability of prosecution under international law. In other words, you're going to be carrying out major violations of fundamental international law, so you therefore better rescind the law. And in fact, that makes good sense, because there's, quite apart from international law, there was a War Crimes Act passed by Congress, Republican Congress, incidentally, in, I think it was 1996, which makes what are called grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions a war crime that is punishable by death. Okay, yeah, better rescind it or else you're going to be in trouble, even under domestic law. Yes, that's happening, and it's an utter scandal. I mean, how it ranks in comparison with blatant acts of aggression and, you know, virtual destruction of another country, I don't know how it ranks with that. You can't make that measure, but it's very serious. The Bush administration is quite openly turning the United States into what's called in the literature an outlaw state, a state that has utter and total contempt for international law and opinion of others and so on. We call that an outlaw state. I mean, it's not that they're breaking entirely new ground on this. Remember that the United States is now the only country in the world that has rejected a World Court judgment. It used to have company. Hoxha's Albania had not done so, but now Albania moved toward the civilized world and accepted the judgment, which leaves the U.S. in splendid isolation, and not on a trivial matter. It's on a matter of international terrorism. The court ordered the Reagan administration, 1986, to terminate its terrorist war against Nicaragua and pay substantial reparations. The U.S. disregarded it, bipartisan rejection, incidentally, media as well. The New York Times simply dismissed the court as what it called a hostile forum, because it ruled against the United States, so therefore we can disregard it. Nicaragua then brought the case to the Security Council, where the U.S. vetoed two resolutions endorsing the court judgment. Britain politely abstained. I mean, that's unique, and it's not a marginal issue. I mean, the U.S., in fact, escalated the war and went on virtually to destroy the country. That's a pretty serious fact. I mean, not the kind of fact you're going to read about in the media or journals or history books and so on, but a fact, yes. So it's not that and there are many other cases. The Bush administration, however, is breaking totally new ground. And torture is horrible enough. Invasion is horrible enough. But in some ways, there's even more serious cases. So, I mean, the fate of the species, it's not an exaggeration to say that the fate of the human species is in danger, real danger. There are two major dangers. One of them is nuclear war, which would be probably the end. And it's, you know, can't give a number, but it's the danger is increasing. I mean, again, you can read in the most respectable conservative journals, leading strategic analysts pointing out that Rumsfeld's transformation of the military carries, I'm quoting, an appreciable risk of ultimate doom. And the doom is not always considered so ultimate. Robert McNamara had an article in one of the leading foreign policy journals called Apocalypse Soon, because of the same policies. One of the few barriers to that was the Non-Proliferation Treaty. It has a regular 5-year review. The last one was in May. It ended up as a total disaster. The media version is because Iran wouldn't agree to tighten up the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But the real reason, if you look, and I think Canadian Foreign Minister may have pointed it out, is that the U.S. was simply refusing to live up to its obligations under the treaty, in fact, quite openly. In fact, said in effect, we're bound by the treaty. Okay, that could be the death knell of the species. It's also dismantled the whole array of international treaties that were part of the NPT bargain. That's one side. Then comes environmental destruction. You know, it's not as fast and total as nuclear war, but it's very serious. You can't pretend it's not there unless you happen to be in the White House. There was the meetings in the G8 meetings, you know, the eight industrial countries in Scotland last July. Right before the meeting, the National Academies of Science of all eight countries, that includes the U.S. National Academy, joined by China, India, Brazil, and others, issued a strong plea to the G8 leaders to take urgent action to deal with an impending catastrophe. Well, they couldn't. Didn't get much reported here. I don't know about Canada, but in the British Financial Times, you know, the world's major business journal, they described it very straight out. They said, look, we're facing a really serious global problem. There's got to be something done about it, but there's one difficulty. The White House says it doesn't believe the scientific evidence. I mean, they just ridiculed it, but that's a fact. And therefore, they said that the conclusions of the G8 meeting were just meaningless words. Well, you know, that's pretty serious. And again, it's over the overwhelming objection of the American population. The population very strongly supports the Kyoto Protocols. Neither of the political parties does, but the population does. In fact, supports it so strongly that a majority of Bush voters, think that he supported it because they regard it as so obvious. Well, you know, there's major catastrophes lying ahead, and they're being made worse. The threat is being made worse. Same, incidentally, with the threat of terror. Now, that's a very low priority for the administration. I mean, there's example after example of that, and I suppose the most striking example is the invasion of Iraq. Now, that was undertaken with the anticipation that it would very probably increase the threat of terror. But that's just not important to the Bush administration or the political opposition which supported the war. And in fact, that's just what happened. Reports of the CIA, other intelligence agencies, Israeli intelligence, you know, just go across the board, German intelligence, have pointed out what you can see on the newspapers. Yeah, it's increased the threat of terror. That's just not just a couple of days ago in Jordan. Yes. And it's increasing the threat to the United States and England and others. That was understood. It has now happened. But it just indicates that it's just they don't care that much. I mean, if the U.S. intelligence community gives a subjective estimate of the probability of nuclear terror in the United States in the next decade, their estimate is about 50%. I mean, this means a dirty bomb, not a bomb that's going to destroy the country. But the effects of that would be just incalculable. I mean, quite apart from the immediate effects of the catastrophe. And how serious that will be, I mean, bad enough in itself, even if there were some preparations. But there are no preparations. I mean, that was what we saw at Hurricane Katrina. I mean, there's Homeland Security, there's FEMA, all of them. They weren't ready. And the reason is because the Bush administration has simply downgraded them. FEMA, which is supposed to be responsible for dealing with catastrophes, was folded into another government organization, downgraded. A lot of its leadership, most expert people have just left in disgust. And when Katrina came along, they just weren't ready to do anything. Imagine what will happen with a nuclear dirty bomb going off in New York.
Evoking, it seems, even less outrage than the use of torture are the surging numbers of American prisons, which hold more than 2 million inmates, giving the U.S. the highest rate of incarceration in the world. What relationship do you think the phenomena of mass incarceration has with the brutality that's being waged against non-citizens by the United States? And what are the historical precedents for such a lockup?
Well, there's a very simple fact about that lockup. It coincides with neoliberalism. It's a systematic correlation. If you go back to around 1980, the proportion of people in prison in the United States as compared with other industrial countries was about the same. The United States is a little to the high end, but it's right in the middle of the spectrum of industrial countries. By now, it's probably 5 to 10 times as high. Crime hasn't increased. In fact, crime rates have either stabilized or declined. This is just a way of getting rid of what amount to superfluous population under neoliberal principles, which the United States, the United States imposes them harshly on others, on weak countries, but it partially follows them itself, so does Canada to a limited extent. And everywhere they've been applied, they've been an economic disaster. I mean, there has been growth in the past 20, 25 years, but it's in the countries that disregarded the principles, like East Asia. But in the United States, they've applied pretty well. This is, a unique period in American-U.S. Economic history. We've had about 20, 25 years in which real wages for the majority of the population have stagnated or declined. Alan Greenspan's being lauded for his marvelous stewardship of the economy. Well, you know, marvelous if you're not part of the large majority of the population. For them, it's never been anything like this before, except for severe depression briefly. That's 25 years. Meanwhile, the effect on the working population has been extremely harsh. I mean, you hear that the auto industry is reeling under the pressure of foreign competition, and wages have to go way down. Wages of auto workers have to be cut by 2/3 and so on, a lot of them being thrown out. How many managers and bank directors and others or CEOs are having their wages cut by 2/3 or looking for a job as a secretary? Well, I don't have to answer the question. It's not it's a disaster for the working people. It's not a disaster for the people who own the country. I mean, they're doing fine. In fact, what wealth has been created in these 25 years has gone into very few pockets. It's very high levels of inequality have developed, the benefits have declined, and so on. The result is a lot of social dissolution. In fact, there are measures of what are called social indicators. How society actually work? You know, child malnutrition, youth suicide, abuse, crime, things like that, a whole collection of indices. From about right into the mid 1970s, they kept improving. In fact, they very closely tracked economic growth. So more economic growth, better the social indicators. In the mid 70s, they separate. There's increasing economic growth, not as much before, but it increases. But social indicators start to decline. In fact, by 2000, the last time it was estimated, it was about at the level of 1960. Well, this leaves a substantial, basically superfluous population. People, do it. You want to get rid of them. It happens that there's a close, very close class race correlation. And on top of that is a whole history of racism. So you got to get rid of these people somehow. If it was, say, Colombia in South America, you carry out what's called social cleansing. You know, you murder them and leave them under a bridge or something. But we're a civilized country, so you throw them into jail. The mechanism is primarily a so-called drug war, which is crafted so that it targets the most poor and depressed parts of the population. And I think I forget the exact numbers, but something like 50% roughly of the people in federal prisons now are on drug-related charges. That has nothing to do with use of drugs. Doesn't have any effect on it, in fact. And they're mostly a very high proportion of blacks. And the number of women is increasing sharply. In fact, the number of there was just a study by, I think, UNICEF of the number around the world of children who are in prison with life sentences and no possibility of parole. Right? Children. Well, it turns out that the United States has more than the rest of the world combined by a large factor. I wish I remembered the numbers, but you know, almost all of them were in the United States. The only other countries mentioned, I think, were Israel, Tanzania, maybe China, but with much smaller numbers. I mean, it's absolutely shocking. Children without, for life sentences. A lot of them were children who were, you know, at the scene of some place where a murder took place, like black kids involved in a robbery attempt and somebody else killed someone. Okay, he's in prison for life. And it's I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with. Partly it's a way of getting rid of people you don't want. Partly it's a way of contributing to fear in the general population. You know, you manipulate. One of the ways to control people is by frightening them. So you frighten them with, Hispanic narco traffickers going to destroy us, criminals on the street. In the case of Reagan, it was black women driving in their Cadillacs to the welfare station to pick up, to steal your hard-earned money. One thing after another. And if you're going to frighten people, you have to make them punitive. You have to carry out punishment. Okay, doesn't do them any good, but somehow enables you to control people who you're in fact shafting.
I'm Joe Broderston. You're listening to a CKUT special presentation with Noam Chomsky.